and I got lost coming here. So, sorry about that. We have I got delayed. We have one apology from the minister. She has arrangements that were prior arranged the engagement, so she couldn't drop it at the last minute. And I must again apologize for what happened last week. You know, I said something like we need to combine the matters that we'll be dealing with on the agenda today with the presentation of the strategic plan of the department. And I was advised otherwise that these are matters that are carried over from last engagement, that we need to close those chapters and then open new ones. We can't combine them. Otherwise, they'll remain hanging, for lack of better word. lack of a better word, hanging. It's not a good one. Anyway, I'm using English as my ninth language, so please bear with me. the acting DG is stuck in traffic. He'll join us later. And we've got capable managers here who'll take us through some of these reports, and then the DG will make additions when there is need to make additions, or he will participate when we are discussing the issues. On the agenda here, we have briefing by the Department of Labor on the challenges, analysis of the working environment, strengths, and the way forward, inclusive of the work in progress report on improvement of labor centers, And then there will be briefing again on the fishing industry, on the recommendations made by the portfolio committee during the oversight visit. Those are the two issues we'll be dealing with today. I think we know each other by now. We don't have to go through introductions again. I see lots of new faces. But anyone who is going to speak should introduce themselves and what division they come from DOL, which division of DOL, and your name. Over to you, whoever's leading the delegation. Over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Siyanda Zondeki. I'm the Deputy Director General for Inspection and Enforcement Services. As you have said, that these faces are familiar. We've got the delegation from the department, from Pretoria, and also from here in the province, in the Western Cape, from our provincial office in the labor centers. Our presentation will be in two parts, as you have indicated. The first part will be done by Mr. Mkalipi, who's the Chief Director for Labor Relations, and our Chief of Operations, Ms. Dudu Mutwane. And the next presentation will be done by Mr. Lamati, who's the Senior Executive Manager in Inspection and Enforcement Services. So I'll immediately hand over to Mr. Mkalipi to start the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, honorable members, and thank you, colleagues. The presentation, we're asked to come and talk about some of the challenges in the workplace, and my colleague, the COO, will deal with the labor center side of it. We've tried to look at this topic, link it to our strategic plan for 2011 to 2016, and also to the decent country work program as agreed by social partners at NEDLAC. We'll just deal with the summary. We'll look at how we look at unemployment, as also this information coming from Centre South Africa, the issue of the growth of typical employment, promoting employment within the workplace, and sound labour relations, and what we believe should be the way forward in dealing with these issues that we'll pick up. And we'll provide some statistics that were published in the second quarter of 2010 by State South Africa. They will deal with consequences of in the workplace in terms of pressure on job security, impact on trade union membership, and representativity of bargaining councils in the different sectors. I think the first issue, the issue of unemployment rate, that publication also obviously would have changed now because State South Africa has published other figures. Therefore, the information that we're publishing here, it's not the up-to-date information, it's not the current information, because these slides were drafted well before State South Africa published that information. But what's clear, I mean, the information is that the provinces that are the most poor provinces have got higher employment rate. I mean, that's what this is trying to show, that KZN, Western Cape and Limpopo, employment rate lower than the national average when you look at it. It's only Limpopo, which is an exception out of the what we would call smaller, poor provinces that have done better in creating employment in that quarter. That was, remember, it was 2010 stats. It's not the current state. I mean, possibly if you look at the current state, I'm not sure it might have changed. We have not looked at that. And if you look at it in that same quarter, if you look at Northern Cape, Mpumalanga, and Northwest, where the province with the highest unemployment rate at around about 30.1, 28.1 and 28, both Northwest and Mpumalanga at 28.1%. I think that's the most important issue here. Whilst the national unemployment during that time, you remember the recent stats, the employment rate has dropped by, I think, 1.8 is the recent state. But in that second quarter, the employment rate remained constant. But what was very clear in the stats that were set in is that the age group 15 to 24, there was an increase in employment rate in that age group by 1.3% at that time. And it shows the concentration of government on this age group trying to get employment for the youth is targeting the right areas. And we say for that same group, employment on year-on-year went up by 3.2%. Now, I mean, this is just a pie chart that shows unemployment, the age group in terms of the population of South Africa. As you can see, the age group 25 to 34 make 40% of unemployed group. And the age group, if you combine the age group 15 to 34, it makes up 72% of the people who are unemployed. And it seems the more experience you've got and the older you are, the more chances of getting employment in the labor market, because from 55 to 64, the unemployment rate is very low at 2.3%. In terms of population group, this doesn't say anything new. Unemployment rate went up to all population groups, except black Africans' rate remained constant during that time. But, I mean, if you look from the base that they are coming from, Africans, they have got the highest unemployment rate, although it remained constant at that during that time. The year-on-year picture shows that the unemployment rate went up to all, for all population groups except the Indian community, which went down about 1.6. African 3.8 went up 3.8 percentage points, among colors 1.8. It shows the race group. And they have said that for the Africans, it was constant. It has not changed, although the base that they're coming from is very low. The issue of typical employment, we're hoping When we're drafting these slides, we didn't want to put this area because we didn't want to start the debate on the bills on labor broker and people employment here because the bills are not here yet. But we're trying to show that 2000 to 2010, the increase in typical employment in South Africa from 1.5 to 3.8 had increased by 20 to 28%. This is the phenomenon that we're talking about that we're trying to deal with in the bills when they come to Parliament. And 25, it's estimated that 25.8 typical employees employed through employment agencies on long-term or short-term placement. The remainder are employed directly by companies like ATCO and other companies that are operated in this area. And it shows that, I mean, if although there's been a large increase in the rate of typical employment, the majority of people who are employed typically in terms of typical employment, not labor brokers, are employed directly by big companies. Because if you look at it, temporal employment service labor broker in terms of our statistics and the RIA document that was issued by government says 25.8% are employed through temporal employment agencies. There are many forms of typical employment in the labor market. It's not only people employed by labor brokers. When you talk about typical employment, you look at people who are employed on fixed-term contracts, who work sometimes for years for the flexibility of not complying with labor legislation. People are employed fixed-term contracts. They earn different salaries than people who are on a permanent contract and all of those issues. And the other area is people who are part-time or temporal work who are also vulnerable, and also the other area, subcontracting and outsourcing arrangement. Now, when people talk about typical employment, most of the time they think that it's only about labor broking, it's only about people who are employed by labor brokers. But in terms of our research that we've done, is that typical employment cut across people who are also employed directly by companies, either on fixed-term contract for years, some of them for years, employed on a short-term fixed-term contract, the contract being renewed on a daily basis, on a monthly basis, precisely because when the contract ends, the employer would not have to pay retrenchment pay. When they go to the CCMA, the employer's defense is that there was no fixed-term contract. There was a fixed-term contract, therefore the people have not been dismissed, the contract has ended, and all of those issues. There are many people, as you say, that are part-time who are employed through labor brokers. The 25.8%. Subcontracting also plays in this area of typical employment and outsourcing. And therefore, in our intervention, we've got to directly intervene and deal with all these areas, not concentrate only on one area, that is labor broking. And these are some of the reasons that our clients and their business are indicating as reason for typical employment. They talk about increased flexibility in staffing arrangement at the workplace. They talk about the response to project-related changes in staff needs. They talk about outsourcing and subcontracting of non-core functions. In these days, you never know, I mean, what's core, not core. You find companies are outsourcing many of the functions under the guise that it's not core function, even mining, underground now, companies are outsourcing that function to somebody else when they are mining companies. You never know what's really core. It's a very, very difficult, it's a moving target that you're dealing with. And employers are saying that they are using this to avoid their obligation under the law. I mean, precisely because when we talk about a fixed-term contract, they are trying to avoid going to the CCMA when they go to the CCMA, they will say they were not employed, they were on fixed-term contract, we did not dismiss them, the contract has ended. And that's their defense most of the time. There's no retrenchment pay for these workers. And then all of the other benefits that are in the law, they can easily bypass, and that's why they opt for this kind of arrangement. And the other attempt is attempt to lower wage bill and benefit of entitlement. And I mean, worker companies go out, I mean, normally, we use an example of this. If you are a farmer, you want people during your harvesting time to pick up your oranges as pickers. and you employ them on a fixed-term contract, is there any reason for them, for those employees, to earn less than the employees that are permanent jobs because they are on a fixed-term contract? And when they are doing exactly the same job, and employers use this typical employment arrangement then to lower cost and exploit workers in that way. The consequences of a typical employment is insecurity in terms of workers, where job security does not exist, it's not there. Workers cannot join trade unions because when they join trade unions, the contract is ended. The ability of trade unions to exercise their constitutional right in terms of social dialogue and freedom of association is hindered because precisely there's no job security. Workers have got problems in accessing their benefits, such as pension fund, provident fund, those benefits, and even retrenchment packages, I've already indicated. There are differences in wages, benefits available to permanent and part-time workers when they are doing exactly the same job, they've got the same experience, they've got the same qualification to do the job. The only difference is that I'm permanent, the other one is fixed term contract, therefore they earn a different salary, a lower salary. And the other consequence is that unions find it very difficult to organize these workers because as soon as they are organized, their contracts are not renewed, and then the union must start afresh organizing new people that have come in. It affects the freedom of association of those workers and their constitutional rights. And the issue then, the issue of flexibility in terms of staffing arrangement that we've talked about. And the issue also, I mean, this issue of equal employment affects the promotion of employment equity. It makes it, the transformation of the workplace very slow, measured against employment equity. And also the public sector, as we said, is performing far better than the private sector in promoting of employment equity in this area. And there's no doubt that there is resistance to change in terms of these areas, and the skills constraint playing a role in also in the implementation of employment equity. And just to give some also information in the labor market in terms of how employment equity has fared, I mean, in terms of the years, if you look at the EAP of the African people, 75.3, and the colored 11.3, and the Indian, that's as we put it, and you look at the representation over the years, in 2009, the Africans constituted 20% at senior management, and the colored 61% when their EAP makes up about 73%. And this is the kind of information that we thought we should give as part of the problems in the labor market, in the representativity, in the different areas of the labor market. The last column talks about the economic active population in the different grouping. And the three columns, 2001, 2009, talk to what do they represent against the 73.5. They make 73.5, but they represent 20% of that areas in terms of the labor market. And it goes on to the other grouping. The white males, the white will represent 62% out of 12.2%. And the consequences of this in the labor market of this non-transformation is that at this area, senior and top management, there's no doubt, is still dominated by white males. White males dominate on this area. The representation of disabled people does not exist in 10 years. There's still discrimination in terms of remuneration based on race and gender. It's difficult for young people to access employment opportunities. And the labor market remains weak after 2009's recession. And that's what protecting vulnerable, that's what encouraging vulnerable workers. There's been a decline in this recession for about 8% employment between the fourth and the second quarter of 2008 to 2010. We know that around about 1 million jobs were lost during the recession. And there's been an increase in strikes and labor disputes during 2010 when compared to the previous year. The average settlement rate for 2010 was about 8.3%, up to September 2010, compared to the inflation rate, the CPI, which was around about 4.7%. Therefore, a settlement rate, collective bargaining for those workers that are represented by trade unions, did very well to caution workers against the vagaries of inflation, because the average inflation rate increases has been far above the inflation rate. the persistent senior gap in senior management persists, and capacity challenge for negotiators and organizers. I mean, there are challenges in terms of capacity for trade unions in negotiations. And if we look at the number of strikes and the trends that have taken place since 2006, as you can see, the trend in terms of strike has been going downwards. If you look at 2006 to 2009, from 99 to 51 incidents of strikes that have taken place, and they went out in 2007 as a result of, in 2010, as a result of the public sector strike that has taken place and the other strikes that take place during that time. The number of days lost, as you can see, 2010, that's a public sector strike. It went out drastically in 2010 because of the public sector strike. I mean, if you look on the other years, 2009, you had very few number of work days lost during strike action, and 2008, they were very, very, very low. But 2009, because of the public sector, went out. And if you look at the number of days lost by disputes, wages make up the bulk of the number of days in terms of dispute. There are other working conditions, disciplinary processes, disciplinary matters. We're hoping that during the amendment, the issue will be discussing the issue around strike, around disciplinary matters, because the law provides that disciplinary matters, if you dismiss, the CCMA or the Labour Court should deal with this, and we're not sure whether should you be able to go and strike when there is an avenue in terms of the law on how you should deal with those issues. If the law says if you dismiss, you must go to the Labour Court, should you be allowed to go and strike? Those are kind of issues. But I mean, what is important is that wages and working conditions make up the bulk of the number of days lost during strikes. The consequences in terms of the labor environment is that because of the recession and because of the typical employment that exists in the labor market, the conflict between the relationship between management and union has increased. I mean, you see it in negotiation, you see it at NEDLAC. The relationship has become more adversarial than conciliatory, and that's the consequences of atypical employment and the state of the economy. The consequences are the consequences of weak negotiation and communication structure within the organization. There's an increase in terms of non-compliance with agreements and sector determination that are published by the minister. And there's low commitment and morale in the workplace as a result of insecurity, as a result of atypical employment. And there's poor interface between collective bargaining and productivity. You don't see many productivity agreements that are negotiated through collective agreements to make sure that the economy keep up pace as we negotiate agreements. Now, what's the way forward? We think the labor law amendments will deal with some of these issues, and we're hoping that they should be coming to Parliament very soon. The need to strengthen the Department of Labor Inspectorate, and my colleague will talk about the issues around the labor center issues, which will touch on the issue of the labor inspectorate, rebuilding the public employment services. I mean, the bill will deal with the issues of the public employment services bill that we'll be putting on. And we believe that we need to relook at our engagement with social partners at NEDLAC and other foreign bargaining council. And we've agreed, I mean, there's been an agreement at NEDLAC on the decent country work program for the country. We think that implementation of that decent country work program should be a priority for all stakeholders. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
My colleague will finish the other part of the presentation.
Yes. The DG came in here now. He is having another meeting with he's going to make a presentation with the minister, wherever they are. So I've decided that we'll recuse him. And then Ms. Andazondeki, the DDG, will be the person who's holding the fort in his absence. Your Royal Highness.
Kwame. I am the CEO of, in the Department of Labor. Chair, progress report on the improvement of labor centers. I thought, just by way of background, I would like to present by presenting our footprint throughout the country and the core functions and the establishment, the staff establishment of the labor center before I go into the progress. Just in brief, the Department of Labor has representation throughout the country. There are three headquarters, the labor headquarters, the unemployment insurance fund, UIF, and the compensation fund headquarters. We have representation in all nine provinces through 125 labor centers. And below the labor center, we've got satellite offices, mobile offices, visiting points, and we also have representation in Tucson service centers. The next slide just shows a brief high-level description of what is a labor center, a satellite office, a Tucson service center. A mobile office is obviously our mobile truck linked through 3G and what a Tucson center is. Just in brief, you can see there that in the provinces, we've got 5,767 posts, 5,252 of which are filled. These stats are as at the end of January. The vacancy rate stood at 8.9%. So we are mindful of the president's call in the State of the Nation address that all posts must be filled in the public sector. So we are working down the vacancy rate.
Sorry to interrupt you. Just a question. Do we have this presentation in a paper format or somehow that we can take it away? It's in this document, but later. Okay, thank you. I beg your pardon.
And maybe if you could just help me. My numeracy levels are very, very low. What is 8.9% in actual figures? Because we have 5,767.
Yes.
So if you
it's
could
just give me the number. 515 vacant posts. Yes, 515 vacant posts at the end of January. Thank you, Chair. Now, by way of core functions that are offered in our labor centers, we've got public employment services, which includes the Unemployment Insurance Fund, the UIF, the Compensation Fund, and Inspection and Enforcement Services. Just briefly, what Public Employment Services offers are the following services: the registration of job seekers, registration of vacancies from employers, career counseling and guidance, recruitment, selection and placement, what we internally call matching and placing, from the vacancies registered by employers and from the database of people seeking employment, then we do matching and placing. We refer also to skills development, the FET colleges that we work with, or learning opportunities in terms of CETAs. We also disseminate labor market information, and we offer special services to designated groups like people with disabilities, domestics, and farm workers. I'm getting an echo. In terms of UIF, Chair, labor centers pay benefits to employees who have contributed to the fund, and unemployment benefits if people have been laid off, sick and illness benefits, maternity adoption and death benefit, just in brief. Under the compensation fund, labor centers receive and record compensation of injuries and diseases on duty, and they forward their application to the beneficiary service unit for processing. And the labor centers. Processing and paying and adjudication of the claims is done in the compensation fund HQ. Under inspection and enforcement services, here it's the core function, inspection and core inspection functions in terms of compliance to legislation, compliance audits, and the registering of all complaints in terms of labor legislation breaches, and then we investigate them. Now, in 2009, Chair, if I may get into the real brief now, in 2009 there was a review of the current service delivery model, and the objective of the project was to review the location of labor centers to ensure accessibility in terms of the not distance norms which have been discussed currently under outcome 12 and physical accessibility to our buildings. The other objective was to ensure that the labor centers are able to provide an effective one-stop service, which includes full processing of unemployment insurance applications at the labor center, a fully IT-driven registration service, and front desk. Currently, we are receiving manual applications. The committee took a presentation last week on the impact the Siemens delivered service are having on service delivery. So we end up with systems that are hanging, and we take manual applications. We end up with long queues, you know. So one of the objectives of this project was to have a fully IT-driven, which is functional, of course, registration service. A single fully integrated database of workers and employers. Currently, the systems are standalone and they don't talk to each other. So you look at one database and go to another one and then do the matching and placing that I spoke about earlier. An effective IES case management system. Currently, we receive complaints, we record them manually, we go out, we do inspections, we come back, we also record the outcomes and the recommendations, the prohibition notices, and, you know, things are basically predominantly manually driven for now. We were also envisaging a self-help and off-site service option, and that the inspectors must be provided with virtual offices so that they can spend more time in the field instead of in the offices. The project also envisaged to greatly reduce the number of repeat lines through the use of SMS and email options. Currently, once a person has applied for UIF or compensation, then they phone or come in to check how far my application. If we had an effective system in terms of SMSs and emails, people could receive updates on where in the system their applications are, and reduce the number of clients visiting the offices just to come and inquire how far the claim is. The other objective was to redesign the labor center to make them user-friendly to both client and staff and ensure that they are habitable. We did touch previously on the problems we are having in terms of maintenance and shortages in terms of budget for leased properties and stuff like that. In terms of this these objectives, a benchmarking exercise was done with the South African Revenue Services and Old Mutual. What came out of the benchmarking exercise was clearly that both organizations have a well-developed IT system. They have the skills and the resources in-house to develop and support their own systems. The committee knows that this we do not have. We presented a strategy, and we will be coming back to you in intervals of 3 months, just so that we develop and incapacitate internally so that we can handle our own IT developments that must support the business. The other thing that came out of the benchmarking was the service delivery is well supported by the IT system, the call center, and product specialists. You know, when you go to SARS offices, when you want a VET issue discussed, you go to a VET specialist. If you want a rebate, you go to rebate specialist or income tax specialist. There are product specialists, and 90% of the time you go in and you come back with the correct answer. Progress achieved to date. This benchmarking exercise was done last year, a service delivery model has been developed and an implementation program has been presented. The professionalization of inspectors is in progress. They were given green cards. They were launched last year in terms of assisting them with mobility, laptops, 3G, so that the objective of them spending more time on the field than in the office doing admin is achieved. In terms of accessibility and accommodation challenges, the provinces, the chief directors, the heads of provinces hold monthly meetings with the provincial Department of Public Work representative officers, and in Pretoria, myself and the chief financial officer and our staff have monthly meetings with the Department of Public Works head office, discussing issues at a different level. As I mentioned, the tools of trade have been provided to inspectors. It did not address all the challenges in terms of mobility and their in improving their accessibility, but it has gone some way in addressing the inspector's issues. We are continuing with training of staff on particular principles, especially the frontline staff that are the call face that interact with the public. We've got an SRO bus which was used to pilot the use of self-registration by computer literate job seekers, where they could walk into the bus and start capturing their details on computer. We've also established strategic partnerships with Eskom, the Medupi Power Station in Limpopo, Sasol 1 and 2 in Mpumalanga and Free State to support job seekers. The UIF is initiating a virtual office project in which accredited clients will be given access to submit their UIF claims online instead of coming into the office and queuing. The compensation fund has piloted the decentralization of certain claim functions to provincial offices. As I mentioned earlier, currently the labor centers receive applications, check them to see if they are correct, and then they are sent somewhere else for adjudication and payment. So three provinces are being piloted to improve service delivery so that the applications are received, adjudicated, processed, and paid in the provinces. Chair, I think just in brief, that's the presentation. Thank you.
Do we deal with the last presentation and then we deal with them all, or do we start engaging with these two and then later deal with the last one on fishing? I'll need direction from the House. Honorable Masarumuri? I think it's proper to deal with each presentation. As they finish, we engage them when our minds are still fresh, and then move on to the next one.
Okay, there are two views here, that we listen to all the presentations and then engage, or maybe that we deal with each presentation and then give input. But I think maybe what we should do is let us deal with the engage with the two presentations, because the fishing one is a different it's a different kettle of fish. So, and then after that we'll do that. We how much time do we have? Can we engage for 1.5 hours on the two presentations? Honorable Masarumuna.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Let's also take this opportunity to appreciate the work done. Number one, Chair. Over the weekend, I was reading a book titled The Struggle Against Forgetting. And I also went into reading something about money running away to Bermuda, to Bahamas, to Isle of Man, monies which are not being taxed from this country, runaway money. To Bermuda, to Bahamas, to Isle of Man. Money's on the run. Running for your dear life. Money's which are not being taxed from this country. So it does really, if it was in a typical ANC meeting, Chair, I was going to say, let's go back to the basics and sharpen our tools of analysis again. Because in this country, really, within the South African context of labor market, I can assure you, there's no need for workers to go on strike. Because the country is filth rich. Where does the money go? It doesn't matter whether you are readily competent to create conditions for employment, for creating jobs. The private sector does not come to the party. If they come to the party, they come to the party in bad faith. And by the way, we are a country which is basically built around dialogue. So you can't enter into a dialogue with bad faith. And I can assure you, there's no way in the world, you can go anywhere in the world, there's no way in the world where you find rich people behaving in the manner that South African whites are behaving. I remember When I used to do clerical work at Toyota in the 70s, 77, 78, 79, coming from a rural area, I did not have 10-1 AIs there. With my matric certificate, I was being paid 12 rand a week. And I had to spend 15 years at school. Imagine, where is the future in that? And averagely, the conditions I'm talking about, they still exist today. They still exist. I can tell you from here what the centers are looking like. On my arrival here last year in August, having been away for 18 months, I went into a house in Acacia Park, what Public Works does. The geyser was leaking, the toilet was leaking, and there was a lot of dust in this house. The furniture is like something in 1948, something from 1948. And by the way, this house, you are supposed to stay in here as an MP, honorable MP. You look at the house. They belong to the Public Works. Who has got the guts to call me to Parliament only to be exposed to this kind of conditions? What more about an ordinary worker? If an MP is being treated this way, what about an ordinary worker? Imagine. And here we are. I mean, the conditions are still, I mean, my generation from my education, and some of these conditions are still in existence. That's why I'm saying, Chair, we need to sharpen our tools of analysis again. Really, I can't understand why at this era. South Africa, with the capacity we have in terms of money, we are still not able to create decent jobs. But why? Where lies the problem? Where lies the huge obstacle that we cannot remove? I mean, really, I just can't understand. It's unacceptable. Unfortunately, here, I wish that the big boys and big girls were here to listen to what we are saying. It's so depressing. It's for me, it's like I should go back to the next battlefield, really. I mean, our people can't continue to live in the manner that they do. They can't. I mean, ordinarily, if you get into an office, you would want an office to have water, a toilet. You would want the accessibility of the office to have conditions for a person with disability to get in, reach a toilet, reach an office. You can't put an office at second floor. What about a person with disability? How does he reach that? How does the person reach the office? I don't even know whether public, where sometimes when they get this office, do they go out and do a profile first? What do they do? I remember I used to look and watch at how Telkom used to behave. They would go into an area, sit under a tree, and just draft a report. They don't talk to anybody. They don't say anything to anybody. They sit under a tree, draft the report, go back to the office and present it. That's what they used to do. And I'm sure Public Works, this is what they are doing. They just get into an area and see an office and just imagine you pay rent, there's no water, there's no toilet. When you want to go to the toilet, you walk a distance of about 10 meters. How do you put an office which is not accessible to an ordinary person? I mean, really, this does not, the way I see these things, the public ways, I don't know where they are. I mean, they need to really to check out. They should. Our people out there, they have enough. They have had enough of these things. That's. Unless I'm complaining without options, Chair. Thank you.
More than welcome. Thanks, Honorable Masrumul. Before coming to this committee, I was sitting in the committee on land and rural development, and I belong to a board. I still do. an NGO that deals with helping people to access land. The mandate of people who work in the Commission on Restitution is to help landless people to access land, to help those who have lost the rights on land to have some of those laws, of those rights restored. We as the Department of Labor, whose side are we on? Because with the Commission it says with a biasness that delivering this service with a particular biasness to those who were dispossessed of the land. Now here we've got the Committee of Labor, we've got the Deputy Director General responsible for inspection and enforcement services. Inspectors, what is their focus? Are they biased towards workers, or are they actually helping management to do the right thing? Or what is, you know, I just want to get, who are we? How do we define ourselves? If we are to die as a department, who will come to our funeral? Who is going to weep at our funeral? As we answer this question that will be posed by members, we need to have that in mind. Who are we? Whose side are we on? With all these two presentations, what I get in my mind, in my head, is that we're supposed to be focusing somewhere and not somewhere else. As we give this question, as we discuss, maybe we should, in a way, management should have to touch this issue and clarify me on who we are. Yeah, thank you very much. Honorable Buinam.
Thank you, Chair. Okay,
Honorable Williams, and then Dr. Lutu.
I'll first talk to the
Monadatamo Malisha. Honorable Malisha. Thanks.
I'll first talk to the second presenter, Mrs. McCartney. You indicated that there are 515 vacant posts. Can you explain why can't those posts be filled? Is there no need to fill those posts? Secondly, handling inquiries relating to claims. Your National Compensation Office in Pretoria is totally inaccessible by claimants, totally, in terms of telephonic communication. Many a times there are people phoning my office saying, we've hit the rock, can you please assist us? We got injured at work, we are not working. We know there's money lying there for us, but we cannot access it because you can't access the office in the first place. And I personally pick up an a telephone and try to intercede on behalf of these poor people, and I get as much frustration as they got. No response. The only office that lists that response, we finally pick up the office, is the provincial office in Pretoria. There's a gentleman by the name of Mulivi and a few ladies there. They would really do what they can, but they would also tell you, if we try to access the National Compensation Office, which is also in Pretoria, we can't. Why is it so? You speak to the machine until you give up. Where is the principle of Batubili? Remember, those people got injured at work. Imagine if it were you, yourself, sitting there with children who don't have food, but knowing very well that you have money that you could be accessing to be able to pay your debts and feed your children. Secondly, to the first presenter, you indicated that your stats are not accurate because you wrote your paper, your statistics, before SA Statistics Office released its statistics. You should have updated them before you come to us so that they are accurate. People of between age 55 to 64 tend to be getting employment more than younger people who are first job seekers. And this is clearly because when our young people who finish school go into the work market, they are rejected, they are told they have no work experience. And older people have gained experience over the years because they've worked somewhere else. This is going to worsen if the government puts a ban on labor brokers, because these are the people who actually provide people with short-term work where they gain experience and training, and when they get a permanent job, at least when they go into a permanent job, at least they've got experience and they can get employment. The rate of unemployment also amongst the Indians, it's low compared to other population groups. And one can easily find out why is it like that. You see, the Indians, most of them are traders, and they tend to employ most of their families and relatives. And they don't depend on seeking jobs. They create jobs themselves. We should look at it that way. I think I'm fine now. Thanks.
Thanks, Rowena. Well, there are lots of Indians who are unemployed and who are very, very poor. Abahlala eMthondweni. You know, they too need to be helped to, as job seekers, to be, you know, we need to service them. The community will speak after Honorable Madisha. Yes, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to talk to both presentations at the same time because they're quite intermixed, you could say. There was many instances of non-compliance, in particular with equity and other things. I just want to know, what is the department doing about this? And is the fact that the inspectorate, there's not enough inspectors, is this the problem with the non-compliance? And if so, why aren't they employing more inspectors? The next thing I want to talk about is the 515 posts that haven't been filled at service points. I'd like to know what level these posts are. And also, the President's State of the Nation address last week called on all departments to fill their posts. So I'd like to know what the department's plan is to do that and when they will fill those posts. When it comes to slide 34 and 35 in the second presentation, talking about the objectives, I'd like more detail on the progress achieved. For instance, is there some way of measuring how far you've got? Because what you've given us is very vague. So in other words, then you had these proposed outcomes, and then you gave us the progress achieved, but there wasn't any measurable. I mean, have you achieved 10% of your outcomes, or 2%, or how much have you achieved there? And the last thing, I'd also like to get more information about the job seeker support from Sasol and Eskom, more detail in that. I mean, what type of support are these big companies giving? Are they just training people how to, you know, make, I don't know, leather shoes or something? Or is it real job seeker support? Are they actually giving real training, proper training? Like, for instance, we need welders in South Africa. Are they training welders? Thank you.
Thank you very much. In that order, Dr. Little.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to take the opportunity to greet everybody in this committee because I'm here for the first time. Chair, I think I can only make, you know, general remarks. I haven't got the details and everything like that to work on. But I'm just going to talk to what I have felt myself just on ground could be really very, very problematic. The first thing is now talking about us here. I think myself that it really is time that we get ourselves together, you know. We get ourselves to work and not keep on going back and sorting out this and that and this and that. I think it's time here that we get ourselves, I'm talking to the department and all of us, that we get things now sorted out. Because whilst we keep going to and fro there, we're really not able to see what is happening on ground at delivery. So there's urgency, you know, there's now urgency about that. Now, that's the first point I want to, you know, I want to make. The other one is there has been, you know, people have alluded to inspectors here. And I'm afraid I've got to talk on inspectors because what I have observed in my own area where I stay is that there's a great need for inspectors. A great, great, I don't see them, you know. I see the need for them to be there, but I don't see any inspectors. So things are happening just the way employers want them to go and, the you know, our poor people there, there's no recourse. There's nobody looking after really their interests. For instance, you'll find that, you know, the major supermarkets, for instance, just an example, the major supermarkets use a lot of labor of youth during weekends and holidays, and you'll find that they are not paid. They are not paid by the employer. They are supposed to, you know, to get whatever they get from, if they pack our things there, and then they carry them to the car, and then you sit in there and you drive and you throw something in their head. A lot of the people anyway don't throw anything. They don't give them a tip. They don't give them anything. And the people who don't give the tip are the very people who own a lot of money. You know, they won't give a tip. The boy just carries it, you know, the young man carries it then, puts it in the boot, and then the fellow drives away. So you find that a lot of these youth, and I've asked them, they don't get anything, are not paid by the employer, and we, the public, just treat them the way I've just talked anyway. And these are school children. These are children who are trying to say, I don't want to do crime. During weekends and holidays, I want to do something about myself, and that's the way, and that's what's happening. Now, we are there. What are we doing about the inspectors are not there? I don't know, but it's of major concern. Now, I don't know. I think, I just said, I've never seen inspectors. I've looked for them. I can't find them. Whether they are few or they are doing what, when I was young, I know that inspectors were a problem anyway, because they were not supervised. They were supervising themselves. So a lot of them anyway didn't do the work. So there's a problem associated with inspectors themselves, you know. Who looks after the inspectors to do their work? And you find that they're not doing anything. So whilst we you know, were saying inspectors, but something needs to be done there so that the inspectors become adequate in numbers, and that when they are there, they must do the work. Otherwise, I grew up seeing that inspectors were not working and people were always complaining. And I think it's still like that even now. Now, the frustration, I think we have to recognize as parliamentarians here that, you know, there's a lot of frustration that our people really feel on the ground. And impatience is just growing by the day, you know, because there is absolutely nothing happening to improve their lives in the labor market. I would like to thank very much.
Thank you, Honorable Attorney. Honorable Valisha.
Just one question, because my colleagues here have raised almost everything that one wanted to raise. There are problems. Labor brokerage, where workers feel unsafe. They have no access to all these things, UIF and a whole lot of other things, as you know. Now, in the very many industries throughout the country, you know that the people who are employed there are from outside of South Africa, and that is growing now. Are you then able to rise and say that which you did is scientific, and a proper scientific investigation analysis that you are then bringing here? We want to engage in further discussions. And that will be based basically on what you give to us and say this is a proper scientific investigation that we have had. I'm raising this because as one goes through your report, one believes that there are contradictions. Where you are saying that this has been done, the positives, but then again, there are negatives here. And when one went through your other report, and we'll raise this chairperson when we come to that. You know, the fisheries and so on and so on. Again, there are contradictions which one sees here. And I'm therefore saying, is there any, you know, kind of empirical evidence that you can raise, put here, and say on the basis of this, we then have got to go through this and have the whole thing discussed. Because unless, chairperson, we are able to get that from them, it's going to be very difficult, really, to say we, with this kind of scientific, proper, really, investigation that we have performed in all these industries and factories, etc., we can be able to go on. Now, let them give us that so that we then are able to rise and you know, deal with that. I'll repeat, because I can see that there is some confusion. What I'm saying here is, you know, the scientific evidence that they can bring here before us. Have you, instead of going to two, three factories, for example, gone through, you know, the majority, you know, the majority of the factories throughout the country, where you'll be able, amongst other things, deal with the problem where people will then be able to rise and say, these are the problems that we have. And remember, I emphasize, Chair, the very many people that are there in many factories that we have in the country are people from outside of South Africa. That is what is growing. And I think somewhere the COO has raised that. These are people from Zimbabwe, from outside of South Africa, who are terrified through and through, who cannot rise and say, I'm not receiving UIF, I'm not receiving that, I'm faced with this kind of problem, etc. I'm therefore saying through you, Chair, that once we get that, and no contradictions that I believe we've been able to get, we then will be able to go into proper discussions, and we'll then be able to say, on the basis of that, on the basis of this problem that we have, this is the line that needs to be followed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. It's my first time in this committee, and I'm Ellen Line from the Northern Cape. Chair, as I mentioned, the Northern Cape, it's like something I don't know. everyone is talking about the Eastern Cape and the Northern Cape are amongst the very poor, very, very poor provinces in our country. But when you look at the type of services or the type of resources given to those provinces, it doesn't justify it. My question is, I just want the second presenter to give us a breakdown on what type of posts are vacant and where. Because the Northern Cape is a very vast area, and the area where my constituency is the Carnarvon area. And the only office that I know in that, especially in the Pixley-Kasemi region, is the regional office in the R. And Carnarvon is 410 cases from the R. So as a result, the services of labor doesn't reach those people. Because when you can go back and look at the reports from my constituency office, you'll see the administrator is more like an inspector in that area. All the complaints is added to my office. And at times, he doesn't have the experience or the expertise to deal with those. And in that area, mainly we are dealing with seasonal workers and farm workers who never benefited or always they are at the back end of everything. So can you please give us a breakdown on the posts that are vacant and the labor center, the satellite offices that you mentioned, where are they, in, especially in that region? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think when you do the presentation of the department's strategic plan, the question that I asked earlier about who are we, whose side are we on, should come out clearly. Because that will help us, you see, that when you read a report from the department, it should, there are those words that I like. I want to hear those words all the time. Infringement of rights of workers. Contravention. Imagine what beautiful way. Contravention of the Labor Relations Act. You know, child labor, child abuse. Abuse of workers' rights. And the other words I like to hear, improvement. You know, lesser contraventions, you know. So as we go, those are the words we'd like to hear coming from your mouth. And in certain regions, there will be companies that you know who have contravened every piece of article. You know, actually these guys are criminals because, you see, You make laws, anyone who breaks a law that is passed by Parliament, that person must be arrested. You know? And for them to arrest these people, do you have arresting powers as inspectors? Eh? No, you don't. You see? Now, because you don't have those powers of arrest, you know, it's even better for you. You don't have to fight with anyone. You can only say, Alex has contravened Section 3 of the Labor Relations Act as amended over the many years, or this and that section, you know. This person has done 1, 2, 3. Here's the evidence, go to further, you know. Then they refer to relevant bodies where arrests need to happen. Arrests will happen. Where now we have to take particular action, like, you know, there are fines, I think so. There should be fines. And let us see those things happening. We, you know, you as the department and us, let's open a new page, Bafwet. Let's open a new page of working together and ensuring that we achieve, because our goals are the same. You know, we are driven by one motive, and that is to serve the disadvantaged. To save those who were previously disadvantaged. When we talk about previously disadvantaged people, we talk about the South African workers. And the majority of South African workers are black people. And within these black people, the African majority were the ones who had the receiving end. They were the most downtrodden section of the South African workers. Let's just do a little bit, you know. Let's do more to improve these people's lives. They need to know that when all is said and done, when all around is dark as night, there is a labor inspector to go to. Because we can't define who we are and whose side are we on, or who are we serving. Our inspectors, labor inspectors, when they go to factories, they talk to management. They greet workers, hello, and then they go into the office. And Mary the tea girl will make lots and lots of cups of tea. In some instances, even our labor inspectors get invited to lunch by management. And they end up drinking wine with management. And then from there they go. So I'm just saying that let us do something to change the plight of the disadvantaged. Honorable Masrumule, you had your hand. Honorable Dr. Ituli was the whip. Whip us again. So, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My concern is, and I know it's possible. I mean, practically, when you walk on the street, you get into a bus, a train, you get into a ship, and you hear the stories. I remember at one stage I was talking to Professor Kata Asmat while he was still the Minister of Education. I told him, you know what? What we need to do now, practically, we need to leave our cars, and this is what we should do. But it was left out of court. We need to leave our cars, our bicycles, ships, flying machines, our motorbikes. Take everybody on a skirmish and go out and investigate this environment. I'm telling you, we can make a difference. Everybody must just get out of the office. We must take a walk in a skirmish. Go and look at this environment. My worry is about timelines, because as Dr. Rituli is saying, we cannot be seen moving two steps back, forward, three steps backward, all the time. We need to do something with timelines. And I know there are things that we are capable of doing. Enrich timelines. We are capable. If we can work out here, hand in hand in a skirmish and go and look at these things, we can quickly come about a solution, very quick. But for as long as we wake up in the morning, we go into our offices, we drive our flashy cars, we hear these stories in black and white only. Practically, we have never been there. So if we can go out practically, only at 2 feet, you'll find these conditions. And you'll want to do something about it.
And I guess there was this thing in one of the reports, I think it was with you, that you bought 60 cars, green branded cars, and I'm worried about this one, cell phones to regional managers to improve accessibility. What about the inspectors? You know, because the managers are office bound. They are supposed to be contacted through the landline because they are supposed to be in the office. They are not inspectors. They are not field workers. People are supposed to get cell phones are field workers. And my understanding is that inspectors are field workers. They are not office bound. They are in the office to write their reports and to do some little administration work. But I think more than 80% of the life of an inspector should be on the road, on the farms, in the factories, nasema kishini, you know, not in the office. So I think we need to look at those who know why our priorities. A cell phone should not be seen as a status thing. It's a working tool. It's like giving the manager a shovel and the Malaysia a ballpoint. It's not taking us anywhere. And the laptops. You know, when I listen to these stories about IT, tools of work, and that we have already spent 1.9, we have spent more than R1 billion on IT. And even worse, in one of the reports that we're giving, you said something like people will prefer laptops than desktops. And still, up to today, there are people who are in offices who don't have those laptops. But we've already spent more than R1 billion. It worries me. That's what I'm saying. I want to, as management, relax, take a deep breath. We're opening up a new page. We're not going confrontational, is not going to help us. But I think working together, and we can only work together if the atmosphere is very, I'm trying to create a very good atmosphere. It's not very easy under these circumstances, particularly with this kind of reports that are clashing. That just last week, we were discussing the Siemens contract, you know, that it was supposed to do this and this and that. And now there is a talk about people in the department not, you know, we having a skills problem related to IT. Who is going to help these people who are people in rural? We've got farm workers who needs to be helped too. You know, there are people who are looking for jobs on the farms. Now, if we are to capture, those people cannot, some of them cannot use this sophisticated information about computers. A computer itself is intimidating, let alone a pen is intimidating for a person who is literally challenged. But what more a computer, you know? I grew up in a village in Skukuneland, you know. You find people who, the old ladies who do decorations in their houses, ngoblongo. You know, when they're using cow dung, they'll make very beautiful decorations, very, very straight lines. But you give this old lady a ballpoint to write, you know. She can't even use it. She can't even make a straight line with a ballpoint because it's a foreign instrument. It's intimidating. What more a computer? So, and we are not in a crisis. I think we need to think outside the box. There are lots of people out there who will be willing to help the department without the department paying a single cent. There are students who want placement, experiential placement in the department who are doing IT. Why can't we take some of these kids, give them that experience in helping us to capture information? You talked about piles and piles, you know, of files last week when you were briefing us about the Siemens contract, and that most of the IT people you had were also allowed by Siemens. What is this that we are doing to ensure that we get other people and even get help somewhere from these colleges? I mean, if you budget for this thing, we are actually going to, you'll be presenting your budget in the near future. But if you factor this thing, you know, that you budget for students who will come and help you in data capturing. And I think we can definitely do more. The distribution of these cars and who uses the cars. I've got fears. I don't know what informs this fear. that the cars will be driven by managers and the inspectors will end up still hiking, you know. Let's make sure that all labor inspectors have access to cars because their jobs are mobile. They are field workers. Let's make sure that labor inspectors, because we have already spent more than R1 billion on computers and this, at least some of those laptops should be given to. Let labor inspectors have cars and laptops, because that is what their work is all about. Laptops are about mobile people, and cars are about mobility. They are not about being in the office. But, you know? Yeah. And then, yeah, cell phones must be given to those guys, to the inspectors, not the managers. The managers can contact them from the office, and they can contact the managers from the field with the laptop. With the cell phones. Thank you very much. Who was next on the line? I'm sorry, I got Dr. Lituli, and then was there another hand, sir? Oh, Dr. Lituli, and then the whip. Thank you. In that order.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to go in another angle, which I think again expresses frustration. Chair, we have in our country, I don't know the number of people employed as domestic workers, but you know almost every family of a working of has a domestic worker, one or two, or something like that, and those domestic workers, they come from one source. You know, it's really one sector of the South African population. It's what the chair was talking about there, you know, the really, really bottom. And, you know, and it's the African woman who is doing that domestic work. There may be others, but it's really the African woman who is a domestic worker. Now, these domestic workers are paid anything, you know. Everyone pays this and another one pays that. There isn't really a decent salary for them. They spend the whole day doing the work in our homes, you and I and everybody else here. And then at the end of the month, we pay them pittance, you know, a pittance salary. Now, sometimes I sit in Parliament and just see how many MPs are there. I don't know the number, 400 or 500. And every one of us has got a domestic worker. And they are women, and they come from the bottom of our society, the poor. You know, the poor, the ones who have always been exploited by the systems more than anyone else. Now, We are actually lawmakers. Yeah. The other thing which makes the domestic workers, although their job is, you know, it's accepted that they will always be there and they are there, you know. It's accepted. They are part of the labor force here in our country or anywhere else in the world, which is very important. Now, because they have no training, they just come looking for work, they have no piece of paper, a certificate or anything like that to show what they can do. They've worked many, many years. They can cook, they can do that, and they can do this, and they can do that. They have no piece of paper to show their competence, what they can do in the house. And therefore, we pay them, you know, very little. So that is point number one. Then the other one is we are actually looking at a group of people, the domestic workers, who are always women coming from the poorest of the poor. Now, if these people were paid a decent salary, they are the people who can improve the lot of the people in this country, because they can improve the lot of the people, of their own families. If they earn a decent salary, it means that they can begin to improve life inside their own homes. You know, and that is where it all begins. They will be able to produce a person inside their own home who is then you can and say that we're giving them a better life. Now, I'm not saying we should pay them, the salary that you and I earn or whatever. But my point is, if we paid them well, it will cut across a very large sector of our society to implement what we call improving the lives of the people, because they handle that. Now, I touched on the fact that we are here to make the laws. Now, if we can recognize that it would pay, it would take our cause of improving the lives of the poor forward, and we accept that, then it would take us to the step that we need to make to come up with the laws which are going to make sure that, in fact, domestic workers are better paid than they are paid at the moment. But not minimum wage or whatever you call it, but recognizing that we want them to be better paid. So we should go ahead perhaps and look at whether we can come up with a law that is going to make that absolutely, possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Look, I think the first thing is around I think there's a lot of discussions and debates and inputs around the role of inspectors, and I think we need to get into specifics. We need to get into what are the deliverables. We need to get into what do we expect on a daily basis an inspector is supposed to be doing. We need to get into performance benchmarks and all of those things. I think that's very, very important. We also need to get into how do workers have access to inspectors, and whether inspectors, when they do impromptu visit, what is it that they do? We need to get into all of those things as part of the review of the role of labor inspectors, and also as part of looking into the offices, infrastructure, and all of that. I think that's the kind of information that we need to start exploring. The second thing is that with regards to unemployment and all the issues that were raised about that, I wasn't earlier enough to hear you say that the statistics were compiled before StatsSA released their information. But I think, however, the information contained in the document is quite helpful. Of course, we would really appreciate getting a much more updated information. And I suppose even on our own initiative, we may even be able to get that updated information. But obviously, the worrying factor countrywide is the 73% plus unemployment amongst young people. There's a very funny solution that has been suggested over time, that we should allow labor brokers to continue to operate, as they're the only and viable solution towards youth employment. And labor brokers are free to operate now as we speak, and they've not really resolved the labor crisis, the unemployment crisis amongst young people. So I think to basically suggest that, keeping them is actually the solution is actually nullified by the fact that their existence has not really confronted the crisis of unemployment. So that solution, I think, on its face before it even goes any further. The crisis that we're facing is the availability of jobs, the capacity of our economy to, open up job opportunities, particularly for young people. But the other crisis linked to that is the crisis of skills development, which I think a lot of efforts are being done in both regards, to ensure that we create jobs and to also ensure that we skill young people, skills which are very critical not only for, creating sustainability of work, but also skills that are going to contribute into building our economy and, have a continuous cycle of, what is a sustainable livelihood. So I think that's very, very critical that we have to emphasize that. The other point I think linked to this, and maybe also linked to the professional employment services, is how do we reduce the cost of looking for a job for young people, in particular, somebody who's never been to a job. And I see all the services that are being provided. But there are also very manual and by-the-way things which we'll never think about and which I hope that we need to, which I think that we need to start to think about now. The cost for a young person to get into town, to go and actually look for a job, the cost to prepare yourself for an interview, because if you are to work as a clerk at Toyota, you need to have a jacket, appear clean, and all of those things. The cost related to all of those things, so your transport, and so forth and so forth. And I think these are some of the things that, your professional employment services need to be looking at. What kind of solutions and interventions do we need to propose in order to reduce the cost and the burden on young people to basically, look for a job, and it will obviously be a short-term intervention, because the crisis really is around the huge urbanization that is taking place, people moving towards the city centers, Cape Town, Johannesburg, and all the major cities, and basically leaving work, and maybe that's not where jobs are created, may not in this instance be the responsibility of the Department of Labor, but because there is this exodus to the cities, how do we make sure that we reduce the cost, of young people or for young people to, and for everybody else maybe, to really look for work? The information I think presented around the non-core outsourcing and that, mines even do that, that miners are on a short-term contract in many of the instances. Some of them are labor brokers, because the actual function of mining in some mines is not regarded as core. I mean, I don't understand why somebody in the mining industry but regards mining as non-core. In fact, I don't think that any function linked to the work of any institution or company should be regarded as non-core. If we're here to make legislation, it is core for this institution to make sure that the rooms in Parliament are clean. It's a core function of Parliament, to make sure that the legislative process as it gets developed, or the oversight process as it gets developed, happens in conditions that are better. And it applies to any particular industry. But what I found more interesting is, which I hope that we'll also have to look at into the future, there are government departments that regard certain workers non-core, and you haven't given us that information. And have outsourced certain, functions. So it's not only the mining industry, even government departments which use labor brokers. And I hope it's not the case even with the Department of Labor, because, how do you use, how would you justify using labor brokers to basically monitor the very same labor brokers on whether are they employing proper? But I think that's the kind of information that, we can probably accept in writing, Chairperson, in terms of government departments that actually use, labor brokers and have outsourced and all of that. And then the final point I wanted to raise is around the inequalities and the wage gap. Those numbers there, 70% of Africans are economically active, and only 20% of them are in top and senior management. 61% or what? No, in terms of whites. 62% of 12% whites are economically active, and 62% of them are in top and senior management. That is disgusting, to say the least. And that we cannot allow that situation to persist. It is something that the Employment Commission, Equity Commissions and all of that needs to be looking at. And I think this should even be the basis used to close down certain companies. We cannot, you see, government should take responsibility where responsibility is due in terms of certain things remaining the same. The private sector should also take responsibility where it deliberately refuses to transform. We cannot have a situation wherein the economy is still in white hands. The president said when in his State of the Nation address, some of the things were caused by apartheid. And gradually, a lot of people will not, really take that explanation and will take matters into their own hands. And I think before that happens, institutions that have been created to ensure that the law applies, because this is illegal, that you've got the senior management, and it reflects in the income inequalities. It reflects on some of the discussion we should have in the future about equal work, equal pay. It reflects also in terms of the ownership of the economy in our country, because those who own these companies, these factories, determines who works for them. So we've got to change the ownership structure. As yet, it is not our responsibility here, but we've got to change the top management structures of all the companies. There should not be a company that is allowed to have 61% of its senior managers being white. It just should not be allowed. And I think that it should be on one of our top responsibilities as the Department of Labor to make sure that as we institute equality and equity within the labor market, we take up also the question of equity and equality within the top management structures. I think for me that's what is very, very critical. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Now I wanted to say to the Chairperson that we should not lose focus. Oh.
Which Chairperson? Chairperson. We know you've not warmed up that chair properly.
I know that...
We'll get there.
Now that the chair should control the meeting so that we don't lose focus on what we are discussing and end up drifting into discussing labor brokers. We're going to have a festival of ideas. That time is going to come. I think we thought that let's give to the department to respond to some of the things. I know we've gone on, we raised for nearly 38 minutes of questions and comments. Most of the things are comments, but we need to respond, comment on the comments that were made by the members so that we get direction about where we're going, what are the doables, what are those things that can be done immediately, we need to move out of this meeting knowing that at least this one will be done immediately. Law enforcement, you know. When Honorable Masrumule talks, he talks about the skirmish line. What did you say about the skirmish? Yeah, something like that, you know. But it's a very beautiful language. If we all understood that language, I think we'll be giving instructions and things will be, this will be done by Wednesday. This one done. Yes, sir. Dismissed. But, you know, inspection and law enforcement. This is, I'm going to adopt this division as my pet division. I'll be talking to you all the time, Messiana. You know, you'll even get used to my voice. I'll phone in the morning, I won't phone after 12. And I'll phone you each time after 6 in the morning, unless there is something very, very urgent that needs to be addressed before those hours. I'll give over to the department to respond to and advise us further on who are we.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We welcome the comments and appreciate them, and we'll try and respond to some of the issues raised. I will talk to a few issues and then hand over to my colleagues who will address specifics in terms of the presentations that have been made. The first comment, Chair, around going back to the basics and sharpening our tool. I think we've taken note of that. With the implementation of the legislation that has been promulgated over a decade now, we've picked up some implementation challenges. And also the analysis that has been given, we had to look at the labor market demands and its challenges and then look inward and say what is the capacity that we have within the department to respond to those labor market challenges and the demands. Hence, we have adopted the legislative review process that is currently underway. I think Mr. Mkalipi spoke about the legislation that are going to be brought before Parliament. We have been getting criticism as well around weak enforcement of the legislation. Hence, we are now trying to criminalize non-compliance to legislation. And we're hopeful that we will win during the negotiation process and achieve that so that it's an offense not to comply to the law. Also, we're looking at increasing the powers of inspectors because, as I said, that with the implementation of the legislation over the years, we've picked up the challenges and the weaknesses and the loopholes within the legislation. Hence, we're now increasing the powers of inspectors where they currently have to secure an undertaking with the employer where there's an area of non-compliance. But now we're saying they should be able to issue a fine on the spot to an employer who's non-compliant. So, but Mr. Mkalipi will talk more on those areas that have been raised. Also, Chairperson and honorable members, with regards to who we are as a department, we have a mandate which will clearly outline during our presentation of our strategic plan when we come before you. But just to say, we are about ensuring that labor standards are upheld, the rights of workers are respected, we are there to protect the vulnerable workers and ensure that they operate and work in a healthy and safe environment in workplaces. We also have a target group, unemployed people, where we have to ensure that we create an environment where they can enter the labor market and also promote the employability of those unemployed, and also help them in terms of assisting them during temporary loss of employment in terms of the benefits that are offered by the Unemployment Insurance Fund, and also rehabilitate those who get injured at work and ensure a speedy re-entering of the labor market in terms of our compensation fund. But as I say, Chairperson, we will clearly outline this during our strategic plan presentation. With regards to a comment made in terms of numbers of inspectors, what we have, we acknowledge that fact, that we don't have enough inspectors. We have about 1,000 inspectors across the country. And looking at the fact that we've got about 9 provinces, we have in the average 100 in a province. And I regard that as insufficient or inadequate. Hence, we have made a request in terms of funding, and in this regard, I need to thank this committee with the assistance that they have given us in support of the funding requests that we have made, where we've been allocated now funds to appoint more inspectors, but all that is also only in the outer years of the MTF, which is 2012-13 and 2013-14. So we will be able to appoint more inspectors in the outer years of the MTF. In terms of trying to improve visibility of inspectors, we have adopted some programs because we, as I say, that we have acknowledged that we don't have sufficient numbers, we're not visible enough in terms of ensuring that we're there at workplaces to inspect compliance to legislation. We have adopted some programs where we embarked on blitz inspections on a monthly basis, where we identified high-risk sectors and problematic sectors. Domestic sector is one of those, the sectors that we have identified. Private security is one of those. Hospitality and wholesale and retail are some of those sectors that we have identified, because we realize that we need to do more with the limited resources that we have. Hence, we embarked on this program. We also have what is called a roving team, where we put together a well-experienced and a knowledgeable inspectors in the different areas of focus to do our inspections and audits across the country. And these are just interventions to augment the limited resources that we have within the inspectorate, with the hope that in the outer years we'll be able to add numbers and also improve the skills of workers. Just a note on the comments made by Honorable Whip. We in terms of reducing the cost of looking for a job for those who are unemployed, the intention with the Public Employment Services Bill is to ensure that we have jobs portal, we have self-help areas in our labor centers where unemployed people can just come in and go through the web and look at jobs that are available, and so that they can also do that and match their skills with the jobs available in the market themselves. Those who need assistance obviously will be assisted by our officials at labor centers. We also establishing resource centers in labor centers. We've now appointed career counselors who assist in life skills, where they conduct workshops with unemployed people, where they give them skills around job hunting and also the compiling of their CVs, the interview, conducting of an interview, and so forth. And also they hold career exhibitions where they provide information to the unemployed. And in this regard, I would just hand over to my colleagues so that they can then talk to the other questions that have been raised, and then I'll pick up also on those that are left out. Over to you.
Thank you, ma'am. There are a few issues. Most of the comments that have been made, Ms. Zondek has already factored them. I mean, there's the issue of the steps that's not current. We take that on board. We accept that. Remember, we were here last week. This presentation was supposed to be done last week. Therefore, the time to make those changes was not there. And we will look at it and forward it through to the Secretary just as an update to have the current information. We take that. On the issue, there was a question on whether labor blocking works in youth employment. I think the WIP have dealt with this question. And, I mean, if you look on our slides also, I mean, 25% of people that are employed through the temporary employment services and through vulnerable sectors are employed through temporary employment services. The rest are employed directly by companies. That's the first thing. The second one, as the WIP has indicated, that presently, with labor brokers operating, we still have got 72% of the youth unemployed. Therefore, to argue that that's the answer to our problem seems not to be correct. We agree with to the statement that's been raised. There was an issue on employment equity raised by the honourable member, whether is it because of capacity. I think Ms. Zondek has dealt with the issue of inspectors, what we do in terms of the inspectors, the numbers there. But I think employment equity and all our legislation are a collective agreement, basically. They've been negotiated at NEDLAC. And initially, the assumption was that business and labor would come to the party because this is their document, this is what they agreed on in the negotiation at NEDLAC. If you look at the BCA, you look at the employment equity, you look at the LRA, all of those pieces of legislation has not been imposed by Parliament. There are pieces of legislation that were negotiated at NEDLAC, brought in Parliament. Parliament did not make any major changes in those legislation. They actually took what was agreed by the stakeholders with the hope that because it's a collective agreement of both parties, there will be buy-in from parties. And we have not seen that in the last 10 years. And that's why now we've got to go on and have increased inspection. And that's why you do not have the compliance with employment equity and other legislation. And I think that's the issue that we wanted to. The issue that has been raised by the Honorable Member, Dr. Sulu, that's literally the issue about the malls and the people that are putting the food in it. I mean, this is the crux of the problem. The fact of the matter, if you look deeply on those people, ma'am, you'll find out they are not employed by the mall. They are not employed by anybody. In fact, they do the payment. They pay the person that gives them the check to stand there at the mall to direct your parking and to carry your groceries. The money that you give them, some of it goes to somebody that is not there. When you want to do anything, you don't know who's the employer in that case. And that's the third part of it, and the amendment that we want to introduce, we hope we will deal with this kind of issue. that you raising. On the issue of domestic workers, I think on this issue, Parliament has already introduced a law that deals with domestic workers. The Basic Condition of Employment Act that is passed by this Parliament empowers the minister to set up wages for this sector. And the minister has done that. The minister has issued the sector determination. We are in the process now of introducing a provident fund for domestic sector. We are in that investigation stage that would want domestic workers to have also provident fund. And the minister is investigating that process. And wages and working conditions in the sector are great at the Employment Condition Commission, which is representative of labor, business, and government, where they meet. Whether the wages are set up now in the sector designation are good enough or not, that's not the issue that I'm raising. I'm trying to say the mechanisms are there to deal with wages and working conditions in the domestic sector. The law is there to deal with that. We don't think that there's anything that Parliament has got to do. What Parliament could do, if Parliament is of the view that the conditions and the wages that have been set are not good enough for the sector, then that's the intervention that Parliament should be making, and that's the discussion that we should be having, possibly after briefing Parliament, what are the issues that we took into consideration and what are the rate of wages in the sector. But the tools are there, passed by this Parliament. On the issue of youth employment, as the WIP has indicated, we agree, I mean, as Ms. Zondeke has indicated, that the Employment Service Bill is going to give us that tool to be able to intervene and give all the assistance that the WIP has indicated. There's nothing will prevent us when the Employment Service Bill comes into place to give that assistance. Remember, the Employment Service Bill talks, without having to talk about it, we know it's going to come here, it talks about schemes that will assist the disabled and the people who are disabled and people and youth to enter the labor market. And those schemes could include, as the WIP has indicated, could include issues about bus fares, train fares, what is it, and all those schemes that could be put in place to assist the youth through the Employment Service Bill when it comes. And I wanted to at least deal with those issues that were pending. Otherwise, most of the issues are comment that we agree with the sentiment that I raised, and that we believe that the labor market review that we're involved in now will answer some of the issues, and we'll have that debate at a later time when we're back in Parliament with those issues. Thank you.
Mr. Fick will take some of the questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chairperson. Just to respond to some of the questions relating to the labor center model.
Just a little bit, Mr. Fick, if you could tell us what division you come from, it would be very helpful.
Thank you. Apologies. The name is Kenny Fick, and I am the Chief Director responsible for provincial operations in Gauteng. I will be responding to questions relating to the labor center model and some of the operational aspects of the provinces and labor centers. The first point that I'd like to respond to is that relating to our inspectors, and just to indicate to the honorable members and chairperson that our green cars, and we only have 60 at the moment, and as indicated by the DDG IES, that we have 1,000 inspectors. So this was an initial project that is the beginning of a long road that we have to walk. And these cars are exclusively for the use of inspectors. No manager or chief director is allowed to get into that car unless we are specifically doing inspections. And they are branded, so they are easily visible. The second thing is that all our inspectors, our team leaders, and our specialist occupational health and inspectors have been issued with cell phones for the past 5 years. So they do have this tool of trade. And the third issue around laptops for regional managers, the purpose of issuing laptops to regional managers or labor center managers, is for them to be able to provide a better service at our visiting points particularly, and to go into communities to do information dissemination, as well as to do field work with our communities. So the laptop is not for the exclusive use of the labor center manager, but for use for whatever projects needs to be done outside of the office. The laptop can be allocated to team leaders or career counselors or employment skills practitioners. With regard to the labor center model, the question was, what was the actual progress achieved? How do we measure this progress, and what is the way forward? The labor center model was part of the, or the service delivery model, as we call it, was part of a greater project on reviewing the way the Department of Labor does its work. And the project of doing the review and coming up with proposals is 100% complete. We've done that work. And what is lying ahead now is to begin to look at the implementation program. However, in doing the labor center model and the review of the department, we found many issues that had to run concurrently, such as the development of the case management system for IES, the PES, the Public Employment Services development process, the impact of new legislation on the work at labor centers, the decentralization of the compensation fund. All of these things had to be built in what we saw as our new service delivery model. The result is that we couldn't then begin an implementation plan, but we had to review. We then also requested our labor market information team to do an exercise to determine whether our labor centers are in the proper location, where they should be located, and how they should look, what services should be provided where. And putting all this information together is the process that we have now commenced with, and we hope to complete the process of putting this together by the end of March or early April, the latest, so that we can incorporate it at least in a pilot phase in the next financial year to review. However, we expect this process to take anything from 3 to 5 years because relocation of labor centers is dependent on lease agreements, the public works, the available property, etc. So we're not seeing this as a short-term quick win, but rather as a process that we will go through. But we expect that in the next financial year, we will have pilot sites in both rural and urban areas that will incorporate all the services, especially the new services that we want to do, as well as to make sure that the technology is available at the labor centers to ensure that we can respond to our clients quicker and cheaper, because we are not likely to get a whole lot of money going forward. So we need to begin to do more with what we have. And this kind of thinking is quite a challenge for us, and we're beginning to put this process in place. The question relating to the vacant posts, we do have, as indicated, 515 vacant posts in provinces. In the Northern Cape, there are only 10 vacant posts, and my last discussion with PEMS or with the chief directors is that the Northern Cape has basically filled all their vacancies now. In most of those vacancies are at the lower levels, at levels 5, 4 to 6, and at a lesser level 7 and 8, which includes our client service officers and our inspectors. And the challenge we have there is that our inspectors and client service officers are put through quite intensive training programs and develop quite a lot of skills, and then they are poached. And we're constantly having to replace people. And because they are entry level, these are inexperienced people that we bring in, mostly young people, and we train them and then unfortunately do lose them again, which I think is just a natural progression in any case. So we're not negative about it, but it's an exercise. If you look at the vacancies that we have, very few of them are older than 90 days because of the continuous changeover. However, we do have challenges in the areas of verification, both through the NIA and through the South African Qualifications Authority, which sometimes delay the process. But this is something we just have to manage as best we can. I think I have covered the questions I need to cover. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chair, I think on the breakdown, although the SEEK has answered the question partly of vacant posts, on the actual breakdown, because it was asked twice, I think we can forward the breakdown through tomorrow. But yes, they are predominantly at level 4, 5, and 6. And the Northern Cape, Honorable Ellen Lane, we do acknowledge is a vast province with long distances between and then we have two SOM centers and three mobile labor centers. As for the specific in terms of Pixley Kaseme, I'll have to forward the information in writing tomorrow. Maybe then, if the committee allows, we can just forward in detail where all the labor centers are in throughout the country, in all the provinces. But yes, the distances between labor centers in the Northern Cape are really, really vast. Chair, if the committee allows, we will forward the breakdowns and the details tomorrow when we get to the office. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Fick.
Thank you, Chairperson. My apologies. I forgot to respond to the question relating to our relationship with Eskom at Medupi and Sasol, and I do apologize. The relationship we are developing with both Eskom and Sasol in Mpumalanga and the Free State is based on the Public Employment Services Bill or the system that we want to implement. And what we have done in order to begin the process rather than wait for the promulgation of the legislation is to talk to some big companies and say to them, this is the service that the department wants to offer, and this is how we want to do it to reduce your costs of recruitment and selection and career counseling, and ask them to become partners with us in order to assist them with the recruitment, especially for the new projects that Sasol have undertaken, as well as the Medupi Power Station, and say, can we be your partner in the recruitment and selection so that we can begin to test what we also want to do throughout the country as part of the public employment services system. So this is part of the process of moving forward in which we can assist and see how we can assist and also begin to learn what are the requirements of an employer and how does an employer want us to respond to their needs so that we can provide a service that makes employers happy and not chase them away from the department because of inefficient systems, etc. So that is our relationship with Eskom at Medupi, as well as with the Sasol 1 and 2 projects in the Free State and in Secunda. Thank you, Chairperson.
Chairperson, just one question around accessibility of the compensation fund. I have noted the concern, and we will ensure that we deal with this matter. But the Compensation Commissioner is addressing this issue in terms of putting a structure in place in terms of dealing with the many challenges that office is having. But also, I think the COO mentioned in her presentation that the function is mainly done at head office, which is in Pretoria. But recently, we have decentralized to a few provinces. In Limpopo, in Free State, we have decentralized the function of also processing the payment. And the plan is to ensure that we decentralize the function, the processing function, to all provinces. Thanks.
There could be decentralization of functions, and yeah, it's the best thing. But you see, the responsibility, TDG, still lies with the people at head office. So we can't be told in the future that the inspector in Mosina has been dodgy, not doing his work or her work and all that. At the end, it will be you who hasn't done that job, and it's not going to be nice if it's to happen that way. So there might be this thing given to other people, but the responsibility still lies with the head of department, and the divisional heads will take responsibility for anything that happens in the
in the districts or regions. And the real challenge with the department, again, is that we don't have provincial MECs for labor, you know. So you become like the MEC or whatever, you know. The director general in that province becomes you, you know. So, yeah, let's hope that we do the right things and continue doing them the right way. Honorable Masuru Mune, before we move on to...
I just want us to be reminded, all of us, because not unless I was asleep in the revolution or I missed it somehow, the timelines, the deliverables, the possibilities, the achievables, timelines, you might not be able to answer the question now or respond now, but I need to hear commitment from you about the timeline, the deliverables, the achievables, improvement of centers, accessibility, conditions, that the deliverables, timelines. It might not be now, but we need to hear commitment.
You're telling us is that if tomorrow we go to any of the districts, we'll find that the labor inspector has a laptop and a cell phone, and that they have access to a car to be able to do their job. Because you see, we it's nice saying that we've got 60 cars and we've got 1,000, and if we've got 60 cars and we've got 1,000 inspectors already, there is a problem, you know. How do 1,000 people share 60 cars in the 9 provinces? The phones, because there were problems about communication, that the people in the district cannot get hold of the managers in the office. There was the problem, again, the challenge of bureaucratization of the district. That even when you want toilet paper, you've got to write to the province, and then the province will, I don't know who they write to, just to get one tissue paper for the toilet, you know. And in other instances, there's only one toilet for everybody. I think we'd like to hear some of those, you know, the progress with public works. I mean, if an office housing the labor committee, I mean the labor department, law enforcement and inspectorate, their building is said to be inhabitable. How are you going to enforce good working conditions for workers when your working conditions themselves, your building is not good for human settlement, I mean for usage by, it's like the inspectors are working in buildings that are seen as traps, that this building can, the ceiling can collapse anytime. As you are working, this air conditioning that is not been working for the last 3 years, it's hanging with only 2 poles. It can fall any minute. How are you going to do the job? I think those are some of the things, again, that might be responsible for the high turnover. I mean, if I was working in such an office and I see another job advertised, even if it pays less by about 200 rand, I'll go to that. Well, what makes people to stay on in their jobs? It's not only because there is money somewhere or lots of money, but I think the working conditions and the relations at work, you know, how you relate to your managers, you know, how communication flows. Are you valued? Do you feel valued as an employee of the department?
because if I want to talk to my manager about getting a tissue paper because I want to go to the toilet and I can't get hold of the manager. And anyway, why should I talk to the manager in the provincial office being in the district because there is need for a toilet paper or a photocopier is jammed, you know? I will vote with my feet because I feel not appreciated. So I think it's not only salaries. I think there are the other assets other than the salary, you know. What is it that we are doing, for instance, to scale, to train our people, improve their skills? Is there a program? Because if I know that next year I'll be doing a higher level, it will make me stay on. Because I want to achieve that goal. I want people to pay for it wherever I'm going. Instead of leaving this year, I'll leave maybe after 3 years. You know? And as we train people, what are the kind of incentives that we are using to keep them? You can't send me to school for a year, and then from there I leave you after 2 months, and then you blame me for leaving you. Because there was nothing that tied me to the department for the training that I got. This is the term that I need to serve. If we give you a bursary as the department, you can't leave us after completing. You need to stay on for this particular period. And if you want to leave earlier than that period, these are some of the things that you need to do, including even paying back some of the money to the department. The Department of Health has done it with teachers. With doctors. Why can't we do it too? Somebody said, why can't we do it too? Mangope did it, Matanzima did it, why can't we do it too? So I'm just saying this on a very, very, very lighter note. But I'm saying that we need to learn from other departments so that we improve on their experiences. Are there members who want to fire the last salvo? The last man standing. Mpumalanga. Honorable Williams.
Thanks, Chairperson. Although we did get an explanation for the inspectors and the problems that they're having, it would be nice if we could get a more detailed report about inspectors and the problems that they experience. For instance, what sort of problems do they experience with the employers, with compliance, with their resources? Is 1,000 inspectors enough? And the issue around ethics, for instance, is there a high level of corruption? Because in my previous life, I was a full-time shop steward for SAMU in connection with safety in the municipalities that I was responsible for. And we had lots of problems with the inspectors not actually doing enough against the municipalities that weren't complying with legislation. So if there's some sort of report or statistics on the amount of reported cases, regardless of what they're reported about, the ones that have been followed up on, and what action has been taken, so we can have some sort of idea whether or not these inspectors are actually effective or not. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Williams. There are lots of stories about the inspectors. Actually, if we are to tell stories, if this was not a formal meeting, you would all be laughing about what the inspectors do. There are serious cases where inspectors literally take chuchu from the people they are supposed to be inspecting. They take chuchu, right? But the safety, like the one you're talking about of people who check fire extinguishers, they don't even check them. They sit there, sign papers, and they're given a street allowance, and they go. But only chuchu was high, you know. And I mean, there are lots of such cases. We'd like to hear from you. How many of the complaints did you get from workers, from unions, complaining about inspectors? The other question, TTG, that would be coming from this office all the time is, what action have you taken against unscrupulous inspectors? who are conniving with management against the workers? What corrective measures did you take? Because if those things are not taken, this committee will be forced to take action against management that has failed to take action against, you know, people below them. There are some people below them. So there's going to be lots of action taken against people who are responsible for people who are not doing their work. Because if you don't take action, it means there's a conspiracy between top management and the foot soldiers on the ground. I know it's not true. I know it cannot happen that way. I believe in the universal goodness of humankind. And I know very well that a senior manager cannot conspire with their juniors not to do their work. Let us do more. Let us do more. Let us get more reports about what's happening. You know, we're going to have a meeting of the management committee, and in that meeting, we're going to divide among ourselves, among the divisions in the department, to ensure that when we do, that we don't have to go as a group of 20 people into one district, but that there will be a team that will have to hone their skills around safety and law enforcement, you know, who will work with your division and the inspectors responsible for that. And there will be other teams that will concentrate on other directorates or chief directorates in the department to ensure that when we do oversight work, we do it all at once and it will have an impact. I thank you. Could I give over to... Can we have our tea as we work, because we're working against time? Fisheries. I thought that question was answered when I was outside, so I didn't want to go back to that. And at the same time, this question will have to be answered each time we meet. And we'll get much more detail about this during the strike plan. Who are we? But on whose side are we? Thank you very much. Over to you.